From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for April 30th, 2017. Yep, the last Sunday of April. We're quickly turning our thoughts to May, and, you know, actually on a day like this, we should look ahead to May, given the weather forecast. This is our weekly look behind the politics and policies that shape Chicago, the state, and Washington. So time to grab the Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll try to get your day and your week off to a great start. Well, I'll tell you, this weather is just, I would like to say it's a delightful Sunday, but the rain just won't let up. And
I couldn't believe the wind last night.
Well, and you know, here I'm talking about May. I'm still wearing my winter coat. I mean,
you came in with your winter coat. Yeah, I saw you.
It was so raw yesterday, just with the temperature and the rain not letting up. And as you've got the wind driving that rain right into your face. I mean, it was yuck.
And here it is, the last weekend of April. It, you know, really, you're right. It was more like March or, you know, the beginning
November.
Of March or even November. Yes. Even
That's what it reminded me of more. I guess, you know, a good time to think about the NFL draft on a day like this. But, oh, I mean, I was looking at the forecast. Obviously, we're going into the 50s today. Springfield, they're having, you know, similar weather that we are, except they're going to get up to the 70s today. I think I could deal with the rain a little bit easier if I knew it was going to be 70 degrees.
So outside. Does this mean after the show you're going to just shoot down on I-55 and go to Springfield and experience 70s?
I unfortunately see no good reason to go to Springfield. I don't need to see Groundhog Day in person down in Springfield.
Actually, they are going to continue to see the type of weather that we're seeing because these storms are coming up from the southwest.
Right, right.
And moving along that pattern of St. Louis, Springfield, and ultimately into our area, into Chicago. That's what we've been seeing really all night and into the morning on the radar. Think of this, though. Sunshine Schwanee here.
Yeah.
if this was a snowstorm, we would be just beginning absolutely pounded.
No, we'd be at Gabatoni's right now. We'd be hanging out. We'd be in Springfield.
Well, I did see, like, Denver, I think, got snow, and some parts of Michigan also got snow.
Oh, yeah. And the other day, Minnesota, northern Minnesota, far northern Minnesota, you know, the International Falls
right.
North of Duluth, got some considerable snow up there.
Oh, man.
Come Interesting.
On, come
did you
on,
talk,
May.
Did
come
you talk on, to May. Aunt Jo by any chance?
Well, I did console Aunt Jo on the loss of the Wild in the Stanley Cup playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad to see that my newly adopted Ottawa Senators are just storming right along. A big double overtime victory, 6-5 yesterday over the Rangers, 2-0 in that series. And I can't remember the player's name, but one of the Sens got 4 goals in that game.
Including the game winner.
Yes, indeed.
J.G. Pageau.
Pageau for the win, and about three minutes into the second overtime. So, yeah, I'm still watching the hockey. You know, I can't give that up. But I'm also sad to see Scott Darling being traded off to the Carolina Hurricanes. I mean, you couldn't ask for a better guy, a better player, and I'm sad to see him go, but in some respects, he deserves to be a starter somewhere. And,
right.
And that's, you know, that's just the right thing.
I do find it interesting. Stan Bowman promised change, right? Change is coming.
Right.
We're going to make a lot of moves, and they've got rid of the backup goaltender, Joel Quenneville's best friend, Mike Kitchen,
yep.
And they fired the head coach in Rockford.
Right.
So those are your three changes so far.
And I don't see where that moves us anywhere. I just
doesn't make you better.
No. But I am Sam. I am curious. What do I need to know about Mitch Trubisky?
Big arm, very, very big arm. He could throw the ball probably 60, 70 yards.
Do we have anybody to catch it?
That's a different issue.
Okay.
Very accurate, too. Larry Fedora, his college head coach, said he's the most accurate quarterback he's ever seen at the college level. Only issue is he's only played in 13 games as a starter. So not much there on the resume tape, but what the Bears saw, they liked. And look, I don't know if he's going to pan out or not. Nobody really knows that. The only thing I do like is that Ryan Pace located his guy and went all in for it. How do you go against that? This guy was aggressive. He saw the man he wanted. He went out and got him. So people are critiquing the pick, and they don't like what Pace did, and they're dogging him for trading up. If this is the franchise quarterback and he keeps you relevant for 10 years, this is a home run.
And nobody's going to remember about the dumping the picks to trade
up.
Right,
a third round and a fourth round pick. If this guy is your Pro Bowl quarterback and he's a guy who's going to be here for 10, 12 years, this is a winner.
Now, I'm also curious about this Eddie Jackson.
I'm sorry.
But
he had a broken leg and a torn ACL. Did you see that?
Yes, that's why I'm curious about it. Because, I mean, but I understand he's a great player when he can play. But, boy, that just looks like, some targeting that the other team can do on this guy.
Yeah, torn ACL in 2014, broken leg in 2016. But he's very explosive, say the scouts. In which way is he explosive?
Yeah. I hope Trubisky is, I hope he's the guy.
Pretty soon they'll be calling him Trubinsky.
Right, exactly.
Oh, by the way, I thought about you and Schwanee last night. You know that Schaller's pump closed?
It did.
I heard that.
The doors will not open again. Last night was the last night over in Bridgeport.
I did hear that, yes. Wow. There's...
I'm saddened.
I mean, that's an iconic place. I mean,
that was a Chicago institution.
Oh man!
Sorry.
The weather's truly fitting the mood here. Wow!
Last night was it? Huh?
It was the last call.
Wow. Yeah, a Chicago institution is right. Wow, that's amazing, amazing. Well,
there's another lesson. Never assume that places like that will always be around,
Enjoy them while they last.
Enjoy them while they last. That's right.
Well,
and I'm sorry to hear that.
Of course, last night, too, was the White House Correspondents Association dinner, the nerd prom, as it's known, which
the nerd prom.
You never heard that?
Yes, I have. It's just
you must
funny.
Have.
But... I've heard it, yeah, but it's just funny every time I hear it.
Except, I'm and I know. The president decided to do something else, and we'll talk about that later. But I just think there's an institution that I think may have outlived its usefulness. And I've been to a couple of these and everything, but I think it's just at a time when in this new media world we live in, and the media being critiqued and about elites and that kind of thing. That just kind of feeds into that caricature with all the showbiz types and who you're going to bring as your guest for the table kind of thing. And I don't know.
More about personalities than the real journalistic work.
Yeah, I mean, they even have like a red carpet when you walk in.
Is that right?
Yes. And just, it's a laudable goal. It's for scholarships that the White House Correspondents Association has this dinner, and that's certainly laudable. And they said that they were all there to celebrate the First Amendment, which obviously is very laudable. But at the same time, just kind of feeding into that, as I say, kind of an elite perspective is just makes me kind of uncomfortable. And I wish there's a better way to do it because it. It truly has, devolved over the years into a spectacle that kind of loses the meaning of it. And you already have various media groups like the New York Times that don't attend, basically for that reason. But, I mean, that's not to say I wouldn't like to go with Schwanee there and see you all decked out in the tux. You would fit right into the nerd prom.
I'm your prom date?
You would be my prom date, yes. But, I think actually the last one I went to was Stephen Colbert was gave the rebuttal, as it were. And, of course, he was doing it in the then Stephen Colbert kind of shtick. And it was amazing because nobody got it. I mean, no one really understood who Stephen Colbert was or what he was doing. And, I mean, there were, you know, you're talking about a crowd of about 3,000 people in the ballroom at the Hilton. But maybe a couple of tables got the joke. But no one else.
So it wasn't
did.
Going over all that well.
No, it really didn't. It really didn't. But
look at him now.
Exactly. If we only knew then.
Yeah.
You know, right. Oh man. Well, we got the Bulls are gone now. The Hawks are gone.
It's just baseball.
And
your Ottawa team.
And my Ottawa Senators.
Yeah.
But I went to the Sox game. A week ago Saturday. And
was that the last time they lost?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. That's because look at that, six in a row.
Stop going.
Stop.
If I can bring the mood down one more time, am I allowed?
You're allowed. I mean, actually, when I was watching the Senators and the Rangers game, and I had told a friend of mine that I had adopted the Senators, and immediately the Rangers scored. He said, stop cheering for the Senators.
So this is the second year in a row that the United Center will not host either a Bulls or a Blackhawks playoff game.
Wow.
Second May in a row. Not good. Not good for Rocky Wirtz, Jerry Reinsdorf. They'd like to be playing deep into the summer, but they are both done in April for the second year in a row.
Well, as I said, on to baseball.
And football. And the Senators.
And the Ottawa Senators.
Not those Senators, the Ottawa ones.
The Ottawa Senators,
yes. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Sam's got all of the sports right here. Producer Jasmine's here to field your phone calls at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is by my side holding the umbrella up so we don't get flooded out here in the WGN Storm Center patio. Remember, if you have to tune away, you can find our shows on WGNradio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes just by searching for me, Rick Pearson. Up ahead, we've got Democratic State Representative Anna Mueller of Elgin. And Representative Mueller sponsored a bill passed by the Illinois House last week aimed at closing the pay gap between men and women. And she's also interested in issues involving senior care. Dave's back with the news update at 8, and then I'll have my interview with Ohio's Republican Governor John Kasich. I spoke to the governor last week while he's in the midst of his book tour. His book is called Two Paths. We'll have more news at 8:30, and then we'll speak to Bob Schillerstrom. He's the former DuPage County Board Chairman, who now is Chairman of the Board of the Illinois Tollway. And we'll talk about the Tollway's expansion project on the tri-state and other development issues as well. That's all coming up, but first it's time for a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on a rainy North Michigan Avenue this morning. It's time for our weekly spin through national politics. And, of course, we're now past the 100-day mark of the presidency of Donald Trump. And while the White House Correspondents Association dinner was going on in D.C. last night, the president was in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, counter-programming that dinner to celebrate his 100 days in office. Basically, he launched into a campaign rally-type speech, which basically included spurring crowd chants of CNN sucks, chastising the media. The Washington media is part of the problem, he said. Their priorities are not my priorities, and they're not your priorities. He called out CNN, MSNBC, and the, quote, failing New York Times. That's despite the fact that the president has sat down with New York Times reporters to talk about his first 100 days. So here you have the president who kind of decried this artificial 100-day mark and then quickly worrying about how he might be perceived. And Harrisburg, Pennsylvania proclaims, "We have accomplished 100 days of action. They've never seen anything like this." Well, we've also got the fact that the federal government was able to avoid a shutdown, which also would have been cause for some kind of embarrassment with the White House. But the administration keeps lurching along. But let's kind of go back to the beginning of the past week. And that's when former President Obama ended his 3 months largely out of the public eye when he came to the University of Chicago to lead a forum with young adults on the political future.
On the back end now of my presidency, now that it's completed, I'm spending a lot of time thinking about what is the most important thing I can do for my next job. What I'm convinced of is that although there are all kinds of issues that I care about and all kinds of issues that I intend to work on, the single most important thing I can do is to help in any way I can prepare the next generation of leadership to take up the baton and to take their own crack at changing the world.
Now, the former president did not address his successor by name or even criticize Donald Trump's efforts to reverse Obama executive orders or try to repeal and replace his signature Obamacare Affordable Care Act. But the closest he got was when he spoke of the controversial issues of today.
Yes, we confront a whole range of challenges from economic inequality and lack of opportunity to a criminal justice system that too often is skewed in ways that are unproductive, to climate change, to issues related to violence. All those problems are serious, they're daunting, but they're not insoluble. What is preventing us from tackling them and making more progress really has to do with our politics and our civic life.
Now, I want you to listen to this next cut closely, because what the former president will be saying sounds a lot like what you'll be hearing from Ohio Republican Governor John Kasich, talking about why our politics have become so very, very divided.
It has to do with the fact that because of things like political gerrymandering, our parties have moved further and further apart, and it's harder and harder to find common ground. Because of money in politics, special interests dominate the debates in Washington in ways that don't match up with what the broad majority of Americans feel. Because of changes in the media, we now have a situation in which everybody's listening to people who already agree with them and are further and further reinforcing their own realities to the neglect of a common reality that allows us to have a healthy debate and then try to find common ground and actually move solutions forward.
So in this age of civic incivility in our politics, last week we also had President Trump going to the National Rifle Association convention in Atlanta, where he went after Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren and referred to her by his derogatory nickname.
Only one candidate in the general election came to speak to you, and that candidate is now the President of the United States, standing before you again. I have a feeling that in the next election, you're going to be swamped with candidates, but you're not going to be wasting your time. You'll have plenty of those Democrats coming over, and you're going to say, no, sir, no, thank you. No, ma'am, perhaps ma'am. It may be Pocahontas. Remember that. And she is not big for the NRA, that I can tell you.
So that is President Donald Trump from addressing the National Rifle Association convention. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we're going to break for news in just a little bit, and then we'll be speaking to State Representative Anna Mohler, Democrat from Elgin. She is also the chairperson of the House Committee on Aging. Right now, though, time for a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Just checking my Twitter feed, and I'm glad to see that my good friend Jeff from New York is in his hotel room on Michigan Avenue looking at the rain and says he's listening to the Sunday Spin. Thanks so much, Jeff, for coming into the city and bringing this wonderful weather with you. It's truly appreciated.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin, and I want to thank Sunshine Schwani for the wonderful weather forecast, because anytime we can talk about...
Don't mention it, Rick.
Yeah. What was that about, flash flood warning?
We have a flash flood watch.
Watch, okay.
In effect until tomorrow. Seriously, though, there is a flash flood warning, in some of the areas around Will County, also LaSalle County, that will continue into Tuesday in places. So with this continuing rain that we have, this, you know, certainly is not surprising to see.
No, and as you said earlier, too, if you're on the roads, it is a bit slick out there. So please use some extra caution this morning.
Absolutely. We had a serious accident on the tri-state, blocking three left lanes earlier this morning. That's now been cleared. Also an accident on the Bishop Ford that has been cleared. But, you know, more than likely, you know, due to the slick pavement and people perhaps going too fast.
Right, right, right. So, yeah, please please just take it easy out there and take it for what it is. It's going to be raining all day long. Thanks, Dave.
You're quite welcome. I will bring a ray of sunshine in here soon.
You are always a ray of sunshine. I always say that to you.
Thank you.
Don't I?
And thanks to, yes, you do. And thank you. Thanks to your friend. I hope he's still your friend after you were saying thanks for bringing this weather in. I hope he's still your friend.
Jeff knows me very well. Yes.
All right.
Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is State Representative Anna Mohler. She's a Democrat from Elgin. She's been in the legislature since March of 2014, and she is the chairperson on the House Committee on Aging. Representative, thank you so much for making the trek this morning in the weather.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
I wanted to have you on because last week, you know, and we talk about how Springfield can't function a lot on this show, but last week... you were successful in gaining House passage of a bill, the Equal Pay Act, as it's known, aimed at helping close the gender wage gap in this state. Mm-hmm. And what that did, basically you were able to attract bipartisan support mm-hmm. for this bill, something we don't see much of these days.
That's right, Rick. It was a good day last Wednesday. We were able to, as you mentioned, with overwhelming bipartisan support, actually surprising the number of Republicans that came on board, and I'm very grateful to them, to pass a bill that will address the pervasive wage gap that we see here in Illinois. It's been 50 years since it's been illegal to pay women less for equal work, but yet we still see a gap for white women. It's 80 cents to the dollar. For African American women, it's 64 cents to the dollar, and for Hispanic women, 54 cents to the dollar in earnings, which over a woman's lifetime can total, you know, over $400,000, depending on how long she works. And so In trying to close that gap, we introduced a bill that would, one, strengthen the existing act that we have in place, strengthen the requirement for employers to defend when they are paying their male employees more than women, that they're doing it for legitimate business reasons, either merit, education, experience, et cetera. We also added a provision that would prohibit employers from prohibiting their employees from sharing their wage information. Oftentimes, women will find out that they're being paid less from their male counterparts, and some employers have prohibited employees from sharing that information. It makes it much harder to find out if there are violations occurring if employees can't share their wage information. And then the novel piece that we included in this bill is the prohibition on employers from requiring job applicants from disclosing prior salary information. And this is being done in a few other places around the country. Should this bill pass, Illinois would be the third state to pass a bill to prohibit employers from doing this. And it's aimed at the historic and pervasive inequity that follows a woman throughout her career. So typically women tend to make 6.6% less than men in their first job, coming out of high school, coming out of college. And if you're basing future pay on prior pay, that inequity follows a woman over her lifetime. And so this bill would prohibit employers from using that prior wage history to determine future wage offers.
If it's against the law, though, I mean, why does it still happen?
Right. And that's a huge question. And I think it's part of it is the systemic nature of wage inequity. It's women tend not to negotiate for themselves when they first start out in their careers. And when they do, they ask for less. And this is based on studies that have been done. AAUW did a study in 2013 to try to get at that. You know, why are women still making less, even though it's been illegal for 50 years to pay women less? And that's what they're finding. Women don't negotiate for themselves. When they do, they ask for less. Women often leave the workplace to take care of children or elderly parents. And when they re-enter the workforce, if we're basing future pay on what they had made, you know, 10, 15 years prior, their future pay is going to be less. And so if we just take that out of the equation, you know, salary should be based on the worth in the organization, the worth in the marketplace. It's not relevant. You know, the prior pay is not relevant to what future pay should be. And in some ways, this is a very timely issue that we are addressing here in Illinois. There was a ruling in California, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, that came out just this week that held that it's legal for an employer to base a woman's salary based on her prior salary. There was a woman in California. She had worked for a county, found out she was making less than her male counterparts in the same job, filed a suit alleging pay discrimination. And the original court found in her favor. The circuit court, the Court of Appeals, found that because her wage was based on
the previous
pay, that it was legal for the county to pay her less. And so should our bill pass here in Illinois, that would, well, one, the employers would not be able to access that information. And two, because of language that we've included in our bill, it would make it illegal for employers to do that.
And I was kind of curious, too, that this came out of the Ninth Circuit.
Yes.
Because this is the circuit that has been very active,
right.
Some would say liberally active,
right.
Involving the president's executive orders. Mm-hmm. But yet, and those arguments were made on the floor of the House during by some opponents of the bill about, you know, for issues like payments on commission jobs,
right.
Or things like that. But, I mean, how do you respond to that that argument?
Well, our response is that it's perfectly legal, and it would be perfectly legal moving forward for a prospective employer to ask about job experience, sales experience, promotions, you know, awards or merits that they may have received at a previous job to get at the overall experience, but the salary information itself would not be employers would not be able to ask about that. But there are a whole other range of questions that they can ask. And, you know, it's finding comparable salaries in the marketplace are very easy now with the internet and a number of websites.
Well, and all various studies that
are conducted. Exactly.
Including those studies that determined that the worst job in America is to be a newspaper reporter. So we're speaking with Democratic State Representative Anna Mollard. She's a Democrat from Elgin. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. is our phone number. I'm Rick Pearson. This is your Sunday Spin. Joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Democratic State Representative Anna Mollard from Elgin. We're talking about her legislation, which passed the House, now awaits action in the Senate, in an effort to kind of get to closing the gender pay gap that exists. And I was interested in a comment you made in the previous segment about women tend to settle for maybe less pay in a first job, and it's that kind of starting point that they never catch up on.
Right.
And I guess I'm just curious, is that a reflection of the job climate and just the obviously the desire of somebody, you know, coming out of school and wants to get hired and get that job? Is that a factor in that? And why is it gender specific?
Well, I think that's a very good point. I think that can. And something that we often hear when when graduates start during a recession, they tend to have lower lifetime earnings versus other graduates who may start out in a healthier economy.
In a more robust economy.
So this bill could actually address that kind of situation as well, where you have the misfortune of starting out during a recession. Your first pay may be lower than it would have been had the economy been doing better and salaries were higher. In better times, if you're not basing future wages on subsequent salaries, that lower wage starting out won't be a detriment to you moving forward. But I think so that can affect both men and women. But I think studies have shown that women tend to, and this is not to, there are women, I'm sure, who are many who, you know, negotiate very well for themselves and know to be good advocates on their own behalf. But women more than men tend to not be as aggressive in negotiating or asking for more, especially when they first start out in their careers. And studies have shown that when they do ask for more, they tend to ask for less than their male counterparts and are perceived more negatively. And I think this is just a remnant of our culture in some ways, or socialization. I think things are changing, and we've seen the gap, you know, narrow over time. And I think that's illustrative of things that are changing in our society and our culture. But there still is this difference, you know, between men and women and how they approach advocating for themselves when they're starting out.
And you also pointed out this legislation, while it's aimed at closing that gender gap, but also that it could have benefits for men as well.
Sure. Men who've left the workforce either through a layoff or a downsizing or to take care of their families, coming back into the workforce, they're not going to be penalized for that gap in pay, you know, not keeping up with cost of living increases or pay raises over time. The employer won't be able to base a wage offer off of potentially a lower wage because of the time that had been taken out of the
based
workforce
on a salary from 4 years ago.
Exactly.
or something of that nature.
Exactly.
I know as well as this issue, you're also, as the chair of the House Committee on Aging, are very much involved in issues involving care of the elderly. And, of course, given our budget situation or lack thereof in Illinois, I mean, this has to be a very, very difficult topic to try to address as we see the social service safety net continue to crumble in this state.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We are most of the programs that are aimed at providing services for seniors are being funded technically, either via court order or consent decree. They fall under that 90% of the budget that's still
the one on autopilot.
Right, exactly. So in some ways, that's the good news. But certainly our cash flow situation is making it much more difficult to pay our service providers who are providing these services. And we also know that we're experiencing the aging of the baby boom generation.
So the demands
are increasing for these types of services. And about 30 years ago, the state created the community care program, which is a program aimed at keeping seniors in their homes. And these would be seniors who would otherwise be eligible to go into a nursing home. They need daily care. And it was created to keep seniors in their home and living more independently, and also to save the state money in nursing care.
Sure,
nursing
versus
home.
The cost of a full-time nursing home.
Exactly. And so, but what we're seeing right now is the Department on Aging is proposing a change to that in creating the Community Reinvestment Program, which would provide for the non-Medicaid seniors who are not covered under Medicaid, would receive a different set of and a different standard of care, which we are concerned, and the senior service industry, the senior service community is concerned that this may end up resulting in more seniors going into nursing homes and costing the state more in the long run. So we are holding hearings, and we've been in discussions with the Department on Aging and with our area agencies for aging, AARP, a number of different service providers to talk about their proposed changes. They have submitted rules to go to the Joint Committee on Administrative Rules to make changes through that process. We have concerns about that because it would bypass the General Assembly, and we feel be a less transparent way to make these, quite frankly, very dramatic, large changes to the program. So we're going to continue to have hearings and be in discussions with the department and with our service providers. Greg Harris, Representative Greg Harris, has taken a leadership role on this as well. And so between his committee on appropriations for human services and our committee on aging, we are taking a close look at what's being proposed to ensure that seniors in Illinois receive the same standard of care that they're getting right now, and that we are looking at ways that we can be more efficient, be more effective in providing that care.
What is the department's rationale for making this change?
Well,
I'm not asking you to defend it, but sure. I'm just asking you what do they tell you is the reason to make a change? If indeed this would end up to be more expensive when the goal of the program, as it always was this is a way to make sure that we can save money but also provide adequate care.
Right. We're concerned that the department is shifting its focus from a care management focus, looking at how we're providing care to seniors, to a cost management focus, which in the long run could end up costing the state more. They've identified that this new program would cut about $120 million out of the community care program. And we're concerned with that large of a cut, that there are going to be seniors that are going to lose services and end up, having to go into homes. We understand the difficulties with the budget and the need to save money, but short-term savings, $120 million in short-term savings could result in major increases down the road and to a reduced quality of life for seniors. And that's why we want this type of discussion, these types of changes to at least go through the General Assembly, be proposed through the General Assembly, so that we have an opportunity to really vet and understand how these changes would affect seniors. One idea and one proposal that's been put out there is instead of changing the program for 40,000 seniors, and that's the estimated number that would be affected by this change, do a pilot program and, you know, take a smaller set of seniors and see if it actually results in the cost savings that they're claiming will be achieved under this new program, so that we are not affecting so many people without clearly understanding how the changes will be impacting our communities.
So is there legislation that, I mean, I know you're saying there's hearings on it, and I understand the administration is moving through the JCAR route,
right?
But are there is there legislation that would require these changes would have to be receive legislative approval?
There may be. We still have about a month left before the end of the session. We're going to kind of see how things continue to play out.
It's just another month of another month of May, and there's nothing else to do in Springfield,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
Are we going to get a budget?
I'm still hopeful. I think we can't leave without a budget. I think people are rightly demanding that we solve this problem, that we solve this crisis.
Then you might have to take up permanent residence in Springfield if you're not
if
going to
leave. If that's what we need to do, then I think that's what we need to do. This has gone on far too long and is causing so much damage to our state. It needs to end.
It needs to end.
It needs to end.
It needs to end. Yeah. That's Democratic State Representative Anna Moeller. She's a Democrat from Elgin, and she is the chairperson of the House Committee on Aging. Thank you so much for joining me this
morning.
Thank
you so much, Rick. It's been a pleasure.
This is the Sunday Spin. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll have my interview with Ohio Republican Governor John Kasich, the author of his new book, Two Paths.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio on a drizzly day on North Michigan Avenue in Tribune Tower. We're talking about we're now 101 days into the Donald Trump administration, and questions about accomplishments. A lot of executive orders that the president has signed, getting a Supreme Court nominee seated. But there are continued questions about the Trump administration. And we have the House Oversight Committee chairman, Republican Jason Chaffetz, who's indicated that he will be stepping down. But at some point, Chaffetz is still in charge of the House investigation. And Chaffetz says that Trump's first national security advisor, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, may have violated the law by taking money from the Russians.
If that money was received by General Flynn, and we believe that it was, that money needs to be recovered. That final determination, again, will have to come from the Department of the Army, as well as the Department of Defense. But as a former military officer, you simply cannot take money from Russia, Turkey, or anybody else. And it appears as if he did take that money, it was inappropriate. And there are repercussions for the violation of law.
Now, the White House was anxiously trying to get a major win in its 100-day mark, and last week outlined its tax reform proposal. It would consolidate tax rates, lower tax rates for businesses, raise the personal standard deduction, but eliminate many, many personal deductions, mortgage interest, charitable deductions. Those would still be included, but things like, and we've talked about this on the program before, things like the deduction for state and local taxes, like property taxes, that would be gone, but the overall personal standard deduction would increase. Still, there are a lot of questions of cost, and even Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin says he's not sure how much an average family would save.
Talk about the individual tax rates. You're also talking about eliminating some of those tax breaks. Are you talking about eliminating tax deductions? And which ones are you talking about eliminating, and which ones are you talking about keeping?
Correct. We are going to eliminate on the personal side all tax deductions other than mortgage interest and charitable deductions. We think that will be sweeping reform.
So still a lot of details to be worked out, and We're not sure we're going to see anything anytime soon. Additionally, continued concerns surrounding North Korea, tensions continuing to rise. Arizona Republican Senator John McCain says China needs to step up its pressure to control North Korea, or the results for South Korea and Seoul could be catastrophic.
There's a real complication, and that is along the DMZ, they have artillery and capabilities that would range Seoul, which is a city of 26 million people. That complicates things dramatically, and that's why a lot of the emphasis has got to be on the only power that can restrain them, and that's China. Chinese have cut back on the coal supply, but I was not encouraged when the Chinese came against our air defense system being in place in South Korea. The Chinese have to really be made aware that this could have a profound effect on our relations with China, because if this exchange began, the North Koreans very likely could range Seoul with their artillery, and that could be catastrophic.
That's Arizona Senator John McCain last week speaking to CBS. Last week I had the opportunity to speak to Ohio's Republican Governor John Kasich. The Republican governor was a Republican presidential candidate, actually was the last Republican presidential candidate before Donald Trump secured the nomination. And a veteran of the House, of the U.S. House, he's a two-term governor who's term limited, so his term will be ending. But he's written this book called Two Paths, and it's a book that basically says, you know, we can continue going down this path of divide and of partisanship and of basically just alienating people who you disagree with as an enemy. We can go down that path, or we can start trying to return to a more pragmatic system where compromise isn't a dirty word, and that everybody has to give a little and everybody will get a little, and that compromise can be the key. So I sat down with Governor Kasich, and we talked about this whole issue of civility and things, like I said, that former President Obama spoke about on his trip to Chicago last week. I've read the book, and
You've read the book?
Yes, I have.
Great.
And I have to tell you, one thing I was struck by, just got the book the other day, but one thing I was struck by, a lot of the themes that you talk about here are actually very similar to the recent visit to Chicago by former President Obama, talking about the topics of civility, civic engagement, empathy, listening, and conversation. I mean, it talking from different ends of the spectrum, but there seems to be this kind of, you know, why can't we get back to the commonality that existed before?
Well, I'm slightly aware of what he did in Chicago, and I endorse it, because I don't believe that the challenges that we face in our country, and they're not just political challenges, you know, they're business, they're media, they're sports, that we have to drive the change. We have to drive the ability to change the world from the bottom where we live up, because we should be sending a message to politicians and big-shot CEOs that we expect a certain set of values that should guide you, and this is all about us working together to build a stronger community where we live. It's interesting, as I do this interview, I'm in Boston, and I was on a radio interview, and somebody was trying to say, well, how would you do this? And I said, well, let's think about what happened post-Boston bombing. It was Boston Strong. It was everybody, regardless of who they were or how they voted or how much money they had or what their position was. The whole community came together to say, we're going to make Boston strong and we will be greater coming out of this. I mean, that's just one example of how you can drive dramatic change and positivity from where we live up, rather than waiting for a bunch of people who are up to come and fix our problems.
One of the things you also talk about in the book, though, and with the Boston Marathon issue, and of course, you know, there was a great rallying point there, but that, you know, a lot of the institutions that brought kind of a common sense of purpose and a common commonality, union halls, the churches, Rotary clubs, they're losing membership as people kind of, you know, cocoon into their own systems with.
Well, it may be a little bit of self-absorption. You know, I mean, the churches, for this matter, I think that there are a number of sort of these street churches or these preachers who preach hope and connectiveness. They're pretty popular, you know, but the ones that are out there where the ministers are like political and endorsing candidates or, you know, yelling and screaming about who you're sleeping with or whatever, they have not evolved to a 21st century approach. And the fact is that, you know, faith is really important because it creates an objective value system rather than a subjective one. And the real purpose of it is to bring about forgiveness and grace and connectivity and realizing that the person you're next to has feelings and hurts and we need to kind of hang together. I never read the book, but I am, of course, aware of this book called Bowling Alone. And we cannot achieve much in our society in any level if we don't have significant cooperation. It's one of the things that David McCullough, the great author, and I just discussed earlier today. If you do not have a unanimity, if you don't have a cooperative effort, big, big things really can't ever happen. And so that's why it's so important that we do get together and that we do revive the sense of community. And I think I think part of the problem is that some of the problems seem so big, so significant that we think, I'm just one little person, what can I do? And I think that's just absolutely the wrong way, because you can change the world.
I almost wondered why, instead of naming the book Two Paths, you didn't name it Last Man Standing.
Well, because I think that, look, one of the reasons why I got out of the race when I did is I was very, very concerned that I was going to lose this message that I'm expressing today. If it had gotten to a point where people began to believe that that election was all about me, that it was about, you know, the only thing that mattered was me, that I was a discontent, then I think it wouldn't have worked. And so the reason I wouldn't name it that is because while this book has some really great political insight in it, I think because it tells the story of what it was like to run for president, it's not a political book, as you know, having read it. So, you know, Last Man Standing would have been too much self congratulatory, and the way I did it, I kind of like.
We'll be back with more of our interview with Ohio Republican Governor John Kasich. But first, it's time for a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, 8:20 on this Sunday morning, drizzly Sunday morning in Chicago. Last week, I spoke to Ohio Governor John Kasich, former Republican presidential candidate, about his book, Two Paths. And in the book, he reflects about his life and his beliefs, but also has some very interesting stories about what it was like being on the campaign trail and running for president. And we're going to pick up that interview right now. Well, I did like a couple of the political incidents, the storytelling that you did in the book. For example, when it came down to your decision that you could not endorse Donald Trump as the party's nominee, and that was spurred by the rally that was scheduled to be held here at the University of Illinois Chicago, and that was called off because of the violence that was occurring, the potential violence, and the concern that it was Trump who was the one who was inciting violence.
Well, that was one of a number of things. Look, I am no longer going to support any candidate for public office who is going to engage in activity that's going to divide or scapegoat. I won't do it. I don't care who they are. So the fact of the matter is that it was not just that, but it was a series of things that I objected to. Now, a lot of people, Republicans, thought I was bitter or I was a poor loser. It had nothing to do with it. And it had to do with what I thought we needed in this country. And now that he's the president, you know, I want him to do well. I want him to succeed. And I will praise him where I think he's right, if I'm in a position to do that. But I'm also going to be critical when I see something that I think is inappropriate.
Well, I know that you have said in other interviews that it's too early to give him a grade for this 100-day kind of demarcation.
Right.
But
if you had graded me after 100 days, I would have gotten a D.
Well, but
I'm serious. I would not have done well. I mean, there is a certain learning curve, and then after the learning curve, you begin to find out what somebody's about and what somebody's for. So it's just too soon.
But I think I could argue that given your background of having been in Congress and your work the Budget Committee, that you would have been a little bit higher on that level in which to grade from in as far as just knowing what you're doing.
Well, again, when I became governor, I was acting like a congressman in a governor's job, and it just wasn't going well. And then when my wife finally wised me up and said, hey, you're the father of Ohio, why don't you act like it, I started to do better. So I give anybody a chance to get more experienced in their work and to be more successful. So I'm not prepared to lower the boom on anybody now and make a final judgment till I have a little bit more time.
Well, the only reason I bring this up is because, you know, obviously 100 days, and it's an artificial deadline as it is, but we did have all of these promises that were made of actions that would take place in 100 days, which obviously haven't come to fruition.
Well, it's kind of ironic, isn't it, that many of the things that made me a boring candidate, the lack of hyperbole, of wild promises, that now we're beginning to see them come to where I was when I was running the campaign. But it was a time that I think people thought, oh, well, Kasich, he's just boring. He's soft. He's the only time in my life I ever had anybody accuse me of being boring.
Well, but, you know, you tell this other great story about that first debate, and you're out there on the outside lane. You know you're not going to get much attention. At that point, you're really kind of still into the balanced budget kind of mode that was, you know, one of the great hallmarks of your time in Congress. And you're sitting there, and you're listening to the audience, and you're thinking, here are these lines the candidates are using that people would be booing, and they're applauding. And that the lines that, you know, should be applause lines, people are booing. This kind of, you know, totally bizarro world, and you're standing there up on the stage as some point of that's where this campaign, that's where this whole presidential election is headed.
Well, yeah, I still cannot explain how people could excuse some of the rhetoric and some of the behavior. I still don't understand it. I mean, if I talk like they were talking, a number of them, they would throw me out of Ohio. I mean, it just wouldn't be acceptable. But for some reason, they got away with it. Trump got away with it. And I honestly, what I think is you ought to ask somebody why that didn't matter to them. Because I don't understand that. I cannot explain it.
Well,
except from this standpoint. I think the only way I can understand it is that people are really hurting. And they had somebody who said, well, you got the shaft. It's somebody else that hurt you or took away what you wanted. And so I'm going to fix it all. And I'm going to show them a lesson. And then they just didn't care what he said.
No, it's that victimization factor.
Clinton that they'd have voted for anybody.
Right, and that victimization factor, and you know, and we are going through, you know, times of upheaval with globalization, automation, those, and for older workers, it was, well, let's try something different. But
here's the thing: if you think we see a disruption disruption of jobs now. You just wait to see when we get autonomous vehicles and artificial intelligence and sensor technology. You see, the fact is that people, wherever they live, in our education institutions, whether it's primary and secondary education or higher education, they got to wake up to the fact that they're not doing a very good job in too many cases of not training our young people for the jobs of the future and not giving them appropriate skills. But you see, these institutions really do not want to change, because sometimes people just say, oh, no, 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 that's too hard for me. And in the course of it, the people who pay are the people who are our children or workers who find themselves dispossessed. So you see, this is why it is necessary for everybody to start thinking about, not narrow about, I'm for Trump, no, I'm not, and all that other crap, and start thinking about how they can add value to whatever job they have to improve the lives of people who are around them. That's how they will be judged at the end.
That was my interview with Ohio Governor John Kasich, and the governor is never shy about his feelings, that's for sure. But a very interesting conversation, a very interesting book. He's the author of a book just out this week called Two Paths, and he's been making the rounds of the book tours, and it was a pleasure to speak with him. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to the chairman of the board of the Illinois Tollway, Bob Schillerstrom. Right now, though, it's time for a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. It's windy and rainy. It's everything you always wanted for the end of April in Chicago.
I have some more positive information after the newscast for you.
You have some sunshiny information?
I do.
Do you really?
Just in terms of what we're dealing with versus what other parts of the country are dealing with.
Well, that is true. That is true. Some severe storms and tornadoes in Texas, and severe flooding going on as well. So
more than that.
All right.
Now the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. Nice hard rain coming down here in downtown Chicago, just out on the WGN Storm Center patio. It's not very pleasant out there, Dave, I'll tell you that.
No, it isn't. This all started about, not quite 24 hours ago. And again, if you, not only the rain, Rick, but I'm looking at this low hanging of fog. There's clouds out there. So there, as I mentioned in the news, there could be poor visibility in places. And also the high winds overnight, 54-mile-an-hour gust reported at the Foster Avenue Beach.
Wow. Wow.
54 miles an hour. But here's what I was talking about before we started the news. As you know, as lousy as things are this morning, in Kansas and Nebraska, winter storm warnings and blizzard warnings this morning. So
let's make sure again that that's out in Kansas, okay?
Yes, exactly. I want to emphasize that is not going to happen here. But they are dealing with seriously blizzard warnings and a winter storm warnings in Kansas and Nebraska, because the colder air is still there. But, just to the south, those storms produced tornadoes. Up to seven people now reported dead in Texas.
Man.
And Oklahoma, a report of a woman being swept away by floodwaters in Missouri. So this is a vast, huge storm system that's affecting so much.
And it won't be leaving anytime soon.
Oh, no. No, the flash flood watch continues for tomorrow, but no winter storm warning.
At least we have that. At least we have that. That's why you're sunshine schwanny right there.
Okay.
Thank you, Dave.
You're
appreciate
welcome.
It. Just to close out our kind of spin through the national politics, I mentioned about the concerns over rising tensions with North Korea, and Illinois U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth was on CNN, where she told Anderson Cooper that Donald Trump's saber rattling is dangerous against North Korea unless the U.S. has a plan.
Well, I think it is in one of the most dangerous spots in on the planet right now. That is true. What I'm afraid of, Anderson, is that the White House is ratcheting up rhetoric in a way that has no off-ramp. If you continue to ratchet this up, what happens when North Korea does something that they test the next missile? Then are we then bound to attack them? I'm just very concerned that the White House is ratcheting up rhetoric but has not come to the House or the Senate or the members of Congress with a real plan on what they want to do.
That's Illinois U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth speaking to Anderson Cooper last week after she was part of the bus tour of senators that went to the White House for briefings on what's going on with North Korea, briefings that she described as really a photo op and that didn't tell her anything she didn't already know from reading the newspapers. Well, we're going to switch gears now. Joining me now on the phone is Bob Shillerstrom. Bob is the former DuPage County board chairman, and he is now chairman of the Illinois Tollway Authority. And I wanted to have Bob on because lots of work and planning in place with a $4 billion plan to widen the tri-state tollway. Bob, thanks for joining me this morning.
Morning, Rick. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So what are we going to be doing with the tri-state tollway?
The tollway put in place a number of years ago a program called Move Illinois, which was a substantial investment in infrastructure. It was a 15-year program to spend $12 billion. And one of the last portions or the last projects was to go in and rebuild 294, the central tri-state, from Balmoral to 95th Street. That's a 22-mile stretch, big project. It was budgeted to be about $1.9 billion. For people who drive on that, especially people who drive during the rush hour, they know that it's probably our most congested road on the tollway system. And the board, the tollway board and myself, we just felt that to rebuild the road without addressing any of the congestion or the intersections that didn't work was not a real responsible way to treat our customers. So the plan that we broke out this week and that the board adopted is to add capacity, put a lane in each direction, a new lane in each direction, completely rebuild the road, put a flex lane so we can run buses on the center like we do on the Jane Addams and on the Stevenson, and to fix those troublesome intersections, that intersection where 290, 294, and 88 comes together, and also the intersection down where 55 and 294 come together. So this is a big investment in infrastructure. We think it's the right thing to do for our customers. It will reduce congestion and make the road function better in a safer manner.
So where is the money coming from?
Well, the tollway, as you know, does not use any taxpayer money. We don't get any federal money, we don't get any state money, and we don't have any local money. All of the money that the tollway operates on comes from their users. And this program, as I said, this Move Illinois program, we're about halfway through it. And there have been savings there. Interest rates, as you know, have been at historic lows, so we've saved money on what we've borrowed. The tollway is probably, well, we're one of the main games in town when it comes to construction. There's not a lot going on otherwise, so we've been able to contract with our vendors at lower rates than we might have otherwise. So the bottom line is the $2 billion additional that we need to provide this capacity and fix these intersections, we've been able to find it within our program. There will be no toll increase. There will be no cost to our users, no additional cost to our users.
And I would assume since you guys aren't part technically of the kind of stalemated governmental process that you're capacity to borrow and your credit ratings are much better than what we're seeing for other elements of government.
Yes, we're an independent unit of government to a certain extent. I mean, obviously, we have reporting requirements to the state, and our board is selected by the governor. But from a financial point of view, we are a non-appropriated agency, and so our bond rating is substantially higher than the states, and we are a good credit, and people like to buy our bonds, and we are confident that it will continue to be that way in the future as we are very, very fiscally responsible.
Well, and of course, with the good credit rating means more favorable interest rates and an overall savings compared to other entities of government that we see that are approaching junk bond status and would have to pay substantially greater interest rates in order to cover their debt load. What is the time frame that we're looking at for this for the tri-state project?
The board on Thursday approved this this modified plan, this congestion relief plan. We will now go to design. We will hire designers who will come in and actually design the road. In doing that, we want to be very transparent. There's we have a lot of neighbors along 294 that are concerned about what's going to happen. So we want to have them be part of the process. We're going to have community groups. We're going to reach out to the communities there, and we want to work with the communities. There's many communities there that have flooding, and while we're working on this project, we think we can work with them. We've already signed a memorandum of understanding with the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District, who's in charge of working to reduce flooding in Cook County, to work with them to see if while we're out there doing construction, we can address some of these flooding issues. There will be some on-off ramps that we want to improve or that maybe we want to add so that we can have a positive impact on local traffic and getting people on and off of our road. So the planning process will go on for probably about the next 3 years. In 2018, what we will do is we will start to do what we call pre-construction work. We'll start to work with the utility companies to move the utilities, to acquire any land if it's needed. And then you'll start to see actual construction work probably in late 2020 or early 2021. And then the construction project itself will probably take 3 to 4 years. So we're talking probably a 7-year program here from where we're at right now to when we're all done and we give this improved roadway back to our customers.
We're speaking with Bob Schillerstrom. He's the chairman of the Illinois Tollway. We're talking about the $4 billion plan to widen the tri-state tollway. But don't worry about it just yet. Let them do the planning first. We'll be back with more right after this. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson on this rainy Sunday in downtown Chicago. I'm in the Allstate Showcase studio. Joining me on the phone is Bob Schillerstrom. He's the chairman of the Illinois Tollway. We're talking about the plans to widen the tri-state, rebuild the tri-state tollway. And, you know, Bob, I know already that, you know, as your engineer team and design teams, you know, start to reimagine the tollway here, that the tri-state, that there is the belief that already you have, because of congestion problems, you've got people that are avoiding the tri-state and you know, putting pressure on things like Route 83 and York Road and really building up traffic concerns in the local communities as well.
That's true. With technology the way it is now, when people want to get home as quickly as they can and as safely as possible, and with, you know, apps like Waze and things such as that, they're going to take the shortest route and they're going to use local streets. So we probably have about 130,000 passenger vehicles a day that use the tri-state right now, and then another 25,000 trucks. And all of our projections show that that is going to grow substantially in the next few years. So congestion relief is very, very important. And anybody who's been on the tri-state during rush hour, either in the morning or the afternoon, knows that something needs to be done. And those intersections, they just don't work. We have backups under the main line, which is a safety concern. we really need to take a comprehensive look at this, and that's what we asked the staff to do. We said, go think out of the box, build a 21st century road for us, and come back, and we'll try and figure out a way that we can pay for it without negatively impacting our customers. And the staff did a great job coming back with this this proposal. It will save probably... Our projections show that it'll save substantial time once it's completed, probably 240 hours a year for the average commuter, and you can break that down. That's a substantial opportunity to either spend additional time with your family, time to recreate, or time to do additional work if you want to do that. So we think that's important for our customers. And then when you look at the savings and you look at the lost time when people are sitting in traffic, we think that it may save as much as $330 million annually. So this is a good investment for our users. It'll be beneficial to the local communities because those people who are leaving our system to take that shortcut through those communities, they'll come back to the system because they'll be able to move along at a faster rate. We're thinking that when this is done, that right now our average speed during rush hour is 20, 25 miles an hour, that we can get it up as high as to 45 miles an hour. So this will change the way that people can get to and from work, make it more efficient for them, give them more time, and also make it safer.
Does this project envision new interchanges?
Yes. Perhaps one of the worst intersections in Illinois is where the Eisenhower, I-88, and 294 come together. You've got all kinds of traffic going down to one lane and then expanding again, and we have backups on the main line. So that is a big safety concern. We will be working with IDOT. One of the things that I asked our staff to do on this was, I said, don't be constrained by if it's an IDOT intersection or if it's a tollway intersection. What we have to do is we have to look at this from the driver's point of view, from the user's point of view. And if it's an IDOT intersection, let's work with them to fix it so that the system works. We need to look at this from a transportation system point of view instead of from just a tollway point of view or an IDOT point of view. And the staff rose to the occasion. So we're going to be looking at working with IDOT to fix these intersections, to get them done so that people won't be held up at an intersection, perhaps because it's not a tollway intersection. But
has that been a problem in the past? I mean,
oftentimes I think in the past some of our transportation systems were siloed. And one of the things that we've been very successful at with Governor Rauner in this administration is to unsilo them, to look at it from the user's point of view and not just from IDOT's point of view or the tollway's point of view or public transportation's point of view. We've worked with IDOT. We continue to work with IDOT and will on these intersections. We're going to work with the RTA and PACE in particular on running buses on the shoulders. We're looking at this as a transportation system and from the user's point of view and not from an agency point of view.
Do some of these interchanges in the reconfigurations and reconstruction, are we moving the tollway system to more of just the electronic exits where it's just it's just the I-pass only kind of thing?
Well, technology has improved tremendously, and one of the things I think that has really changed people's view of the tollway is I-Pass, where you don't have to wait in line to pay your tolls. People were so frustrated when they're trying to get to work or they're trying to get home and they had to wait in line forever to pay a toll. So the I-Pass has been, I really think, transformational for the user. About 87% of our payments on the tollway are now made by I-Pass, and our goal is to have our payment system 100% electronic in the near future. We think that's what people want. It makes the operation more efficient, and we're getting close. We're a leader in the country on electronic tolling, and want to continue to do that because that's what our users want.
I also want to ask you, I've been hearing things in the news lately about the Route 53 extension kind of a project, and I don't know where the tollway fits into that kind of a project at all, but you know, there's a project that has been, I think I'm trying to see if the Piatone Airport has been the longer stalled project versus that.
I think it's that. They've been talking about that project for 50 years up there. And that's a project that the Tollway Board has voted to do an environmental impact study on, which, as you know, is the first requirement, a federal requirement, before you can build a new road. So that's where that is right now. That's a political hot potato. There's a lot of people up in Lake County who want to have that road done and think that it will be transformational for their county, like 355 was in DuPage, and like we think it may be down in Will County, and I think it is becoming in Will County. But there's also a group up there that is concerned about it. But the environmental impact study stage is really just an exploration, number one, as to whether or not the road should be built, and then if there's a decision that the road should be built, what are the options, what are the routes, what are the possibilities, and what are the drawbacks to doing it? And it really would answer, I think, many of the questions that the people who are concerned about the road being built have, and also would be a next step and a necessary step for the people who are in favor of building the road.
I mean, I was up in Lake County just about a week ago during kind of rush hour, and you know, there are parts of the county obviously very bucolic, but also when you're talking about two lanes of traffic, one going each way at rush hour, it's hard to go 3 miles in 45 minutes.
A lot of congestion up there. I tell people, I've been around for a long time, and I remember when 355 was being planned and discussed in DuPage County, and when you couldn't get from Naperville to Itasca, it took forever. And we had many of the same issues. And people are concerned about change. Roads concern people. I understand it. But now that the road is built in DuPage County, it's been transformational for our county. It's easy to get around. It has spurred economic development. It has created jobs. And I recognize the concerns in Lake County, but with this EIS project, if it is determined that the road should be built, I'm sure that it will be built in an environmentally sensitive way, and the concerns of the people who have concerns will be taken under advisement.
That's Bob Schillerstrom. He is the chairman of the Illinois Tollway. Bob, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Rick, thank you for having me, and I look forward to talking with you in the future.
Appreciate it. We'll be back with more right after this. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guest, Democratic State Representative Anna Moeller from Elgin, Ohio Republican Governor John Kasich for his interview, and Bob Schillerstrom, chairman of the Illinois Tollway. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening, and do your best to try to stay dry out there if you can. And now it's time to turn things over to Dean Richards.
Yeah, good luck with that keeping dry thing.
Hey,
out
man.
There. It's still coming down here in downtown Chicago, probably worse in some areas. The wind has died down. That's nice.
That's thankful, yes.
From last night.
It was raw.
I am not a petite person by any means. And I went to the Lyric Opera last night.
Oh, My Fair Lady.
To see My Fair Lady, which I'm going to review later on. And I was getting blown down the street.
Really?
It was that windy last night.
Ugh.
Umbrellas turned inside out everywhere you turned.
Yeah, I figured it was not a good idea to have an umbrella yesterday.
Oh, it was a good idea to have an umbrella.
Well, if
not inside out, it doesn't do you any good. But
if it didn't get caught in the wind.
Not a good night to see a show whose you know, one of their main songs is "The Rain in Spain Stays Mainly on the Plain." That much I know. So I'll tell you more about that show. It was a who's who of media last night.
Yeah,
this is the most interesting thing to me. It was the official opening, which means they invite all the
sure.
press, whether you're actually reviewing the show or not.
Right.
Even if you've had nothing to do with the media in, say, 20, 30 years.
Really?
You're still,
still considered
invited,
an invitee.
Which is very nice of them. Lyric Opera's very nice, generous that way. It's just it's an interesting observation of who was there.
Well, I know Rick Kogan was there.
Rick was right in front of me in the line for beverages.
I see. Okay.
Shall we say. Rick was there. Chris Jones was right in front of me from the Tribune. And Mark Caro, formerly of the Tribune.
Right.
So it's like a whole contingent of Tribune people right near the bar.
Oh.
And me.
And then there's you.
Put me in that group also.